Hello, I'm Kimberly Rorschach, Director of the Nasher Museum of Art at Duke University, and I'd like to extend a warm welcome to El Greco to Velázquez, Art During the Reign of Philip III. The exhibition focuses on Spanish art during the 23 years of the king's reign, from 1598 to 1621. At that time, Spain had a huge empire, larger than that of ancient Rome. Wealth poured in from its colonies. Religion, and specifically a fervently mystical form of Catholicism, was intertwined with life at every level. As you begin exploring the exhibition, you'll see late paintings by El Greco. Many of these date to the early years of Philip III's time on the throne. Our exhibition is bracketed on the other end by Velázquez, who came of age just at the end of the king's reign. El Greco and Velázquez are the much-loved and best-known painters of the period. But around them, many other very wonderful, powerful artists were at work. Some are barely known today, even in Spain. We hope that today you'll discover some of them. The first stop on your tour is the large painting by El Greco, with a figure who has his arms outstretched to the heavens.
During the reign of Philip III, Spanish artists took on the challenge of depicting mystical visions. And here we have a supreme example by El Greco. El Greco was the artist's Spanish nickname, meaning the Greek. Indeed, El Greco was Greek. He trained in Italy and then settled in Spain. This is the artist's vision of St. John. John is on the left, his kneeling body like a giant X. In the background, we see his vision, naked figures being resurrected from the dead and given drapery to cover their nakedness. Sarah Schroth, the Nancy Hanks Senior Curator at the Nasher Museum of Art at Duke University, joins us on our tour.
There is a sort of ambiguity of space, that attenuated figure who's reaching up, up, up into the heavens, and he's so elongated, unnaturalistically. He's making him grow almost in our vision.
We also get a sense of mystical energy through El Greco's agitated, heavy paint application. The sky weighs down thickly on the figures.
El Greco was able to do a lot of unusual things during the reign of Philip III, during this period, because he was patronized for the first time by the court. The Duke of Lerma owned his works and collected him, and so everyone else did.
Remember that name, the Duke of Lerma. You'll see a portrait of him later in the exhibition. The Duke was the right-hand man to Philip III. He was the tastemaker for the court and an admirer of El Greco. The music you'll hear throughout this audio guide is from a manuscript found in the archives of the church in Lerma that the Duke rebuilt and adopted as his own chapel. It was recorded in that church as well. Here is El Greco's St. James.
This is a very late work. This probably was not finished. In fact, if you look at the hand holding the pilgrim's staff, you can see it's just sketched in. And the white cloak underneath the green mantle, that's not finished either. You can see so much of the ground, the red ground coming through. The face is finished, and he's given himself a nice challenge here in the tilt of the head in rendering the face in correct perspective. But it's so exciting for us to see an unfinished work because we can see him thinking with his brushes.
This is an example of a new sort of painting in Spain during the early 17th century. It's called the Apostolado, which is a group of 13 paintings, one each for Christ and the 12 apostles. El Greco was the first artist in Spain to paint an apostolado. And he did something radical. He conceived of the images as portraits of ordinary, contemporary-looking individuals. But he combines this naturalism with a stark black background, linking them to the tradition of devotional images meant for private meditation. Here, for the first time in our exhibition, we see a work by Velázquez. This painting depicts the Virgin of the Immaculate Conception.
She was born without sin, without original sin. So she's elevated above in the ether, above the moon, between the moon and heaven.
The doctrine of the Immaculate Conception is not to be confused with the virgin birth of Jesus. The Immaculate Conception refers to the conception of Mary. It says that God removed the stain of original sin from Mary's soul at her conception. In Spain, this belief was fervently held. It was the subject of huge public festivals. The Virgin Immaculate was described as clothed in the sun, with 12 stars around her head and standing on the moon. Here's Ronnie Baer, the Mrs. Russell W. Baker, Senior Curator of European Paintings at the Museum of Fine Arts, Boston.
And the fact that she's clothed in the sun is only implied by these little bits of yellow that you see peeking through the clouds behind her.
Sarah Schroth.
She's very three-dimensional. She's very lifelike. Some scholars have said they think it's a portrait of Velázquez's sister, Juana. And, of course, we can't verify that, but she was obviously a living model with that very tiny chin and sort of fat cheeks and an overbite.
Velázquez was very young when he painted this equally young Virgin of the Immaculate Conception. And it's probably dependent on the sculpture by Montagnès that is also in this room.
That sculpture, displayed nearby, is one of the earliest depictions of the subject. The sculptor, Juan Martínez Montañez, shows Mary as about 12 to 14 years old.
This is dated 1608, and he's one of the first artists to represent Mary as a young girl with that loose hair and hands folded and standing on the crescent moon, which was one of the symbols of the Immaculate Conception.
And the whole concept, this three-dimensional figure with her swirling draperies, has been translated into paint by Velázquez.
Now look at another painting nearby, the one of the Virgin Immaculate, which includes a man in the lower left corner.
We have this monumental image of the Virgin Immaculate painted by Francisco Pacheco, who was the overseer of sacred imagery in Seville. He was responsible for being sure that all the painters adhered to orthodox ways of depicting iconic images. Pacheco was Velázquez's teacher and Velázquez's father-in-law. So if we look at the Pacheco and compare it to Velázquez, we see the great strides the student made coming from his teacher's workshop, whereas the symbolism of Pacheco's image is very obvious. Velázquez naturalizes it. This push towards naturalism is one of the defining characteristics of art during the reign of Philip III, this reliance on what the artist sees.
In this scene, humble shepherds visit the newborn Christ child. Angels come in as if breaking through the ceiling. None of the earthly figures below notices them, although one of the angels at the upper right looks directly at us, the viewers. His pudgy body is full of dimpled flesh, just like that of a real baby. Indeed, the artist Luis Tristán has absorbed the interest of the time in naturalism and likely used live models for some of the figures. Tristán's teacher was El Greco, and we can see El Greco's influence in some of the facial features, and even more clearly, in the way Tristán exaggerated many of the hands. MFA curator Ronnie Baer.
And Tristán's debt to his teacher El Greco is very obvious in the kneeling shepherd at the lower right. You can only imagine that El Greco would have interwoven the celestial and earthly sphere. The spheres are distinct in Tristán.
Peter Gomes, professor of Christian morals at Harvard University, was a recent visiting professor at the Duke Divinity School. He sees a tinge of El Greco's mysticism in the non-human participants in the scene.
Anybody looking at this would, of course, immediately identify the scene as the manger because of the devout attitude of the animals to the rear left. They appear to be in some form of devotional ecstasy.
Here, the infant Christ turns to face us, holding his mother's breast. As she nurses him, the Virgin Mary looks down, her hair loosened. Joseph holds a dove out to Jesus, a symbol of the traditional gift brought to the temple when a firstborn son is presented to God. This painting is smaller than many in this room, which were used in public spaces as altarpieces. This one was likely used for worship in a domestic setting, an affluent home or perhaps a convent. The subject is domestic. It's a quiet scene, the everyday made sacred. The green curtain and carpet-covered table could be reminders of the 17th century worshipper's own home. The artist, Luis Tristan, arranges his figures close up to us. It's a familiar, altogether human subject, encouraging personal connection with the divine. This particularly sumptuous painting is appropriate for its subject, the visit of the three kings, or magi, to pay homage to the Christ child. Above, light streams in from the star that guided them. The artist, Juan Bautista Maino, uses that light to dramatic advantage and to give his figures a sense of solidity. For example, notice in the foreground the shadow falling on the Virgin Mary's blue cloak. Maino seems to delight in painting the textiles, especially the luxurious costumes of the kings. Sarah Schroth notes that when Maino painted this, he had just returned from a long stay in Italy.
You can see that Italian influence, especially in the drapery of the king in the front, that wonderful purple and yellow juxtaposed. And the mother, she looks like, to me, a contemporary Spaniard today. We could just pick her off the streets. And that baby, perfectly formed, beautiful baby. He's looking at real people and using real models. It's a perfect example of a brilliant artist who exists between El Greco and Velázquez that people don't know about. And yet, he was a very important and respected painter of his day.
As you continue to explore this gallery, we invite you to hear a bit of background on Catholicism in Spain during this period. Through the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance, Spain had included people from various religious groups. But from about 40 years before Philip III inherited the throne, every inhabitant of Spain was officially Catholic. By then, Jews and Muslims had been converted or expelled from the kingdom, and Protestantism was not tolerated. The Spanish clergy and nobility saw themselves as the defender of Catholicism, which they viewed as the one true faith. The merest suspicion of practicing any variations on religious rituals or believing outside dogma was persecuted by the feared Inquisition. The Inquisition was a political force as well as a religious one. During this period, there was peace within Spain. In many ways, the Inquisition promoted social stability by suppressing the religious conflicts that were erupting in violence throughout most of Europe. In this work by Vicente Carducho, we see Christ as a captive with the wounds of his torture. He meditates on his coming crucifixion. In Spain during this period, meditation and private prayer took on a new importance. Images of Christ meditating became popular subjects. Look at the other almost identical painting hanging nearby. The second painting is by Eugenio Cajés.
These incredibly moving images by Cartucho and Cajés express, really in a nutshell, what the religious imagery in this show is all about. Cartucho and Cajés were both painters to the king. They're always mentioned in the same breath. But in this comparison, one can really see what different kinds of artists they are. In the Cartucho in the background, you see Mary in her blue cloak, attended by two other figures. In the Cajés, that grouping has been reduced to the single figure of Mary, who, in a sense, replicates the viewer's experience of this very sad, lonely, hurt, and monumental figure of Christ.
If we look closely, we can see a stylistic difference as well. Cartucho's painting is imbued with classicism and elegance. The Cajés image, by contrast, is more inward-looking and expressionistic. You can perhaps see the difference most clearly in the treatment of light in both paintings and the expression on Christ's face. In this picture, the figure on the left is St. Peter. The other man is St. Paul, who is usually depicted as an old man with a flowing beard. This young-looking Paul gestures with a sword. Peter and Paul seem to be arguing over the words on the scroll, which the artist writes in his own imitation of Greek-like letters.
You can imagine them arguing and debating about the text, as they had a very tense relationship. St. Peter understood himself to be the prince of the apostles and regarded St. Paul as a Johnny-come-lately, which he was to the whole enterprise.
Professor Gomes notes that these apostolado paintings harken back to the earliest Christian period.
There's a misunderstanding abroad about the nature of what a saint is. For most of us, we have this sense of a saint as some idealized portrait of perfection, whereas in fact in the New Testament the phrase saint was applied to believer, and therefore a saint was not an idealized, perfect person, as he became in the Middle Ages. So these attempts to turn the abstract saints back into human beings, or more like human beings, is a closer rendering of the New Testament notion of saint than we might otherwise understand.
The man in the lower right corner of this painting is Father Simon. He was a visionary holy figure, but the Catholic Church did not recognize his visions as authentic. Nonetheless, Father Simon had a great following in his home city of Valencia on Spain's east coast. In this painting, we witness his vision. The figure in the left background is blowing on a trumpet, announcing Christ's presence. The setting is Valencia's streets. Though we see a bit of blue sky, it was said that Father Simon walked the streets of Valencia at night as penance. It was on these walks that he would hear a trumpet and then see a vision of Christ with the Virgin Mary and John following him. The artist, Francisco Ribalta, shows the moment in the vision when Christ would stop and look at Father Simon for a moment before passing on. This painting may have functioned as an open-air street altar in Valencia. Many of these altars sprang up in the city soon after Simon's death. This woman is a Spaniard, Saint Teresa. It's by the same artist who carved the painted statue of Saint Ignatius
His name is Gregorio Fernandez.
For me, the most important thing about looking at these polychrome wooden sculptures is to realize that basically they're carved out of one huge piece of wood. And so what we're looking at with Gregorio Fernandez is the Michelangelo of Spanish sculpture.
When Fernandez carved this, Teresa had just been declared a blessed person, the first step in becoming a saint. She died about 30 years previous.
She's an older woman. She died at 67, and he's not idealizing her. He's giving her the plain features of a Castilian woman and large hands. She's holding a book and a pen and a quill pen.
She's life-size. Her mouth is open as if in speech. The pose, with her captured in a moment, fingers animated, was meant to make her feel truly alive to worshipers.
She would write to her nuns, advising them about how to pray, basically, how to get closer to God.
Here, Christ, almost dead after his crucifixion, is yet alive. In this imagined scene, Francis has a mystical vision of the crucifixion. He leans close into Christ's body, embracing him, almost touching the bloody wound with his lips. In the period of our exhibition, worshippers seeking the highest form of mystical ecstasy often aspire to an almost physical union with Christ. Here, St. Francis's union with Christ becomes a transcendent moment, with music being provided by the angel on the right.
This is a unique painted depiction. We don't know of any other paintings of this subject. It's not anything recounted in the scriptures. It is referring to this impulse to use all of one's senses to apprehend and approach the divinity. This is St. Francis's vision of him striving not only to take on the wounds of Christ, which is what he did with the stigmata, but now he has Christ crowning him with his own crown of thorns.
Another unique aspect to the painting is the huge leopard that St. Francis stands upon. To add to the incongruity, it wears a crown. Some people see the animal as an allusion to Africa and the Franciscan missionary work there. We simply don't know. Here, St. Francis hovers in the sky, meeting Christ face to face. On Francis's hands are the bloody marks, the stigmata of Christ's wounds. Christ is represented with the giant pink and orange wings of seraphim, angels of the highest order. They seem at once tangible, muscular, and ethereal. We as viewers don't witness the miracle from earth below. We're up in the sky with them. Both figures are painted naturalistically, making the mystical levitation all the more startling.
This is by Vicente Carducho, the painter to the king.
You may recall Carducho's painting of the captive Christ meditating before the crucifixion.
And this is a totally unique image. I've never seen anything like it, with St. Francis, he's levitating up to the seraphim. The figure in the landscape on the ground is Brother Leo, who was St. Francis's constant companion.
This is one of the many works in this exhibition, which has never before left its original home in Spain.
They're wonderful painters that are in this period between El Greco and Velázquez, and this is a perfect example.
You'll notice a number of paintings of St. Francis in this area. Devotion to St. Francis took on a particular intensity in Spain during the time of Philip III. Many of the most wealthy commissioned images of the saint. He was always depicted in a tattered robe to show his vow of poverty. Again, Peter Gomes.
I would like to think that, in a way, royalty and the establishment upheld the virtues of St. Francis in the hope that people like Francis and others would intercede for them, would pray for them, and would become the means of their own salvation. I'm not willing to give up my goods, but St. Francis has willingly given up his, and maybe if I am kind to him by representing him wherever I possibly can, he will intercede with the Savior for me.
Here we see a man who plays a major role in our exhibition, the Duke of Lerma. He sits a bit stiffly in grand parade armor. His horse is more animated, stepping forward and turning its head toward us. Its splendid mane catches the breeze. On the right, clouds funnel up dramatically. On the left, the green foliage bends over the Duke, framing him. This is the only work in the exhibition which is not by a Spaniard. It's by Peter Paul Rubens, a Flemish artist. He was sent to Philip III's court on a diplomatic mission by an Italian city-state.
And when he was there, he decided he would paint this portrait of the Duke of Lerma, who was the favorite of Philip III. He functioned almost like a prime minister. He controlled access to the king.
The court chroniclers talk about the fact that this man, the Duke of Lerma, and the king issued in a new style of grandeur.
In fact, the Duke was the driving force behind much of the artistic activity at court. He was a tastemaker. Others followed his lead in matters of style. His own collection was enormous, including more than 2,000 paintings. No Spanish nobleman had collected on this scale before. He started a trend for art collecting throughout the Spanish court. Velázquez painted this when he was in his early 20s. It's a portrait of the celebrated poet and clergyman Luis de Góngora y Argote. Velázquez draws attention to his sitter's face by setting it off against a black cloak with no embellishment, with a simple collar of startling white. Góngora's arched eyebrow and furrowed brow make him seem deep in thought, preoccupied. Maybe the famous poet is actually scowling a bit. Velázquez originally included a poet's wreath of laurel leaves around Góngora's head. He decided to paint over it, but it's still visible under X-ray. It does seem like it would have been out of place, a distraction in this dramatic and focused composition. But if you look at the small chalk drawing hanging nearby, you can see why he likely included it. This poet, wearing a crown of laurels, was drawn by Francisco Pacheco. Pacheco was teacher to Velázquez. He ran a famous art academy in Seville. Velázquez married his daughter. This portrait was part of a book of drawings Pacheco made depicting famous men of his time. We can certainly see Pacheco's influence on the painting by Velázquez that we were just looking at, from the pose and format to the direction of the sitter's gaze. But Velázquez decided to paint out the laurel crown on his portrait of Góngora. He wanted to convey the role of the poet solely through the intensity of his face. The reign of Philip III marked one of the richest and most innovative periods in the history of Spanish literature, what we have come to call Spain's Golden Age. We invite you to hear a short selection by Góngora as you explore the other portraits in this area. In the year Velázquez painted this portrait, Góngora wrote a sonnet called On the Deceptive Brevity of Life. Here's an excerpt.
Menos solicitó veloz saeta, destinada señal, que mordió aguda.
Less eagerly did the swift arrow seek the appointed target that it flew to bite. Not more quietly did the chariot gliding across the sand attain the mark. Don't tell me that you think the hours will spare just you. The hours that are grinding down the days, the days forever gnawing at the years? Here we meet the Spanish monarch King Philip III. This was his first official portrait, painted just after he ascended to the throne. He was 19. He's standing in a tent, gesturing to the battlefield outside. The setting is the Siege of Ostend in the Low Countries. At that time, Holland, a Protestant nation, was rebelling against Spanish rule. Sarah Schroth.
And he's being depicted as if he's there at the battlefield, but he's not. He never went to this siege. But it's the image of the young king wanting to carry on the Habsburg tradition of quelling the rebels, quelling the heretics, and being the defender of the one true Catholic faith. So that's what we see here.
He's wearing a particularly opulent suit of parade armor.
That collar is much larger than any king had ever worn before. Those cuffs, also of starched linen, were part of the new style of grandeur that was operating at the court.
At the same time, we see in this period the hints and beginnings of a new kind of artistic naturalism in Spanish painting. Notice, for example, on the left edge, the way the red curtain falls and folds. And towards the right, the way the shadow falls on the young king's slender leg. MFA curator Ronnie Baer.
This is really one of my favorite paintings in the exhibition. I find it astounding that El Greco could paint this still figure and animate him to such an incredible degree. This is the royal preacher, Fray Hortensio Felix Paravicino. El Greco somehow has captured the essence of the man in his face, in this very sensitive portrayal of intelligent eyes, a mouth set in a very firm way, but almost nervous application of paint makes the hands, makes the garment seem to be alive. This uneven line that describes the chair back, I find an incredible artistic attempt to further activate the composition so that the figure is not presented squarely, even though he is presented straight on. The limited palette of browns and blacks and whites is enlivened only by these touches of red in the lips and the Trinitarian cross that the preacher wears on his habit.
It's a fitting tribute to this man who was an eloquent poet and orator, and a great friend and champion of Spanish writers of his day. In fact, Paravicino edited a book of sacred verse. This small room is a reconstruction of the Duke of Lerma's camarín, a special room in his palace designed just for the display of glass and ceramics. Lerma was one of the first mega collectors of his time, and as we see in this room, he collected more than just paintings. The inventories of his collections include rich tapestries, jewels, splendid armor, elaborate clothing, and all manner of gold and silver objects. Near the camarín is a still-life painting by Juan van der Hammen with similar objects. The fruit hanging on the left is a quince. It catches light, but behind there's total blackness. There's a startling contrast of convincingly real objects set against a totally abstract background.
Everyone's always asking themselves when they look at this picture, well, why did he use a quince and a cabbage, and why did he hang them? And I think the answer is simple. It's just a beautiful, brilliant composition of a perfect hyperbola arch. Each one of the objects is stepping out a little closer to us towards our space. But the most important thing about looking at Spanish still life painting in this period is to realize that they were absolutely avant-garde. They were brand new subjects to paint. There have been fruits and flowers in religious pictures, but only as accessories. This was an independent picture with only the subject of fruits, and so there was no narrative.
The artist is Sanchez Cotan. He eventually gave up his painting career to become a monk. We are left wondering if perhaps there is anything spiritual to his glorification of these humble gifts of nature, and to that void, that blackness behind. Cotan made this painting about the year 1600. As you can see in other paintings nearby, his style became enormously influential for other still life painters in Spain. Juan van der Hammen made this still life a full 20 years after the first still life paintings by Sanchez Cotan. Here, instead of humble fruits and vegetables, there's an emphasis on luxury, and dare we say, even pleasure. The covered glass jar contains cherry preserves. There are round wooden containers of marzipan, and the large ceramic jar held honey. In front, jutting into our space, almost pulling us in, is a large spoon with which we seem to be invited to taste the sweets. A last thought from Peter Gomes.
It all looks terribly good, and sensuous as food is, there is the statement, I've made it many times, that the most intimate things that two people can do is not what you think they can do, it is eating.
In the development of still life in Spain, we can see the alliance of naturalism with experimentation that also characterized the religious paintings of the period.
Along with still life, another novel subject was the bodegón, or tavern scene.
Bodegones were part of the new artistic impulse towards naturalism, now extended to everyday life. This one is by Velázquez. He painted it when he was only about 20 years old. This woman is surrounded by metal and ceramic vessels, but we can't tell what she's doing.
And she's turning her head as if listening to something beyond. It relates to the other bodegones by Velázquez that had religious pictures in them, because we do know that there's another version of this that has a religious scene in the background. But here, Velázquez chose not to put it in, so it's more abstract. Now, we wonder, well, is this a Moorish slave? Is this an African household servant? What's interesting about depicting a Moor or an African in this painting is a reference to the expulsion of the Moriscos that happened sometime before, but the Moors were supposed to be out of Spain. So who's this? What's going on in this picture? We don't really know, but I believe that Velázquez, just like El Greco, knew that ambiguity would keep the picture alive for centuries and centuries, because we are standing here still guessing, wondering what it's about.
This is the last stop on your tour, an appropriate place, as Velázquez is the artistic bridge to the next Spanish monarch, Philip IV. Take your time in this last room of the exhibition. Thank you for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed your tour. It's been our pleasure to accompany you on your journey into the artistic worldview of early 17th century Spain, a world in which the natural was aligned with the mystical. This exhibition is organized by the Museum of Fine Arts, Boston, and the Nasher Museum of Art at Duke University. and is supported by an indemnity from the Federal Council on the Arts and the Humanities. The exhibition is sponsored by Bank of America. The exhibition and the catalog are presented with the collaboration of the Sociedad Estatal para la Acción Cultural Exterior. Additional support provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Homeland Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts. The print media sponsor at the National Museum is the News and Observer. The music on this audio guide is by the Gabrielli Consort and Players, directed by Paul McCreesh, and courtesy of Universal Music and Deutsche Grammophon Archive Productions. You can return your audio guide where you picked it up as you leave the exhibition. This has been an Antenna Audio production.